The House Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law is now in session. Apologize for the delay, but we're missing a couple people, but Chair Krieger said he would sit in and provide us with the quorum necessary to get these bills into work session this morning. So we'll start with a public hearing on House Bill 2221A. Is there anyone here to provide testimony? I know we had a work group last week, and amendments, I think, have been forwarded to us. Is there any need for public testimony on this, or should we proceed right to work session? Okay, see no one coming forward on House Bill 2221A. I'll close the public hearing on that bill and open a work session. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2221A was before the full Judiciary Committee on April 1st, where it passed out and was placed on the consent calendar at that time. Some representatives pointed out some problems with that bill. As you mentioned, a work group was formed to work out those problems. Again, this is the bill that establishes the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program in the Department of Justice and makes several other modifications to that program. You should have before you the -A3 amendments, which are the amendments which were spoken of previously. Those amendments do a couple things. First, they restore previously deleted provisions that require multidisciplinary teams to provide for an independent review of sensitive cases. And the second thing that they do is clarify who may participate in child abuse medical assessments. And they specifically define child abuse medical assessment. Again, those are generally restoring language that was deleted from the original bill.
So we're at issue on the A3 amendments, Council?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Then the Chair will move that the A3 amendments to House Bill 2221 be incorporated within the main bill. Is there any discussion? I can say that I did attend the work group with the agency representatives and Representative Richardson, and it appeared to me when I left the room that everything was resolved. I appreciate everyone's cooperation on doing this. I think this does represent their consensus, and basically was to provide for some greater civilian oversight on the protocols used by the agency and to provide some greater protection for confidentiality of records, particularly health records. I think those, I'm sure that Representative Richardson's views were accommodated. Any further discussion on the amendments? Hearing no objection, then the -A3s are incorporated within the main bill, and the Chair will move that House Bill 2221 as amendment be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the main bill?
Just to correct, that's House Bill 2221A, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
2221A. Further discussion on the bill? Hearing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores. Representative Garrard.
Aye.
Representative Wirth. Chair Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
House Bill 2221A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. And the work session on that bill is now closed. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3158. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3158 requires that certain causes of actions related to the improvement of real property be commenced within 6 years after substantial completion or abandonment of construction, alteration, or repair. This bill changes the ultimate statute of ultimate repose from 10 to 6 years, thereby lowering it. You have before you -1 amendments that exclude single-family residential dwellings from that statute of ultimate repose. For those situations, it retains a 10-year statute.
Thank you, Council. On the sign-up sheet, I have three proponents of the bill, and I'll ask them to come forward. Jessica Adamson, Howard Corson, and Larry Seitz. if I'm pronouncing these names correctly. Three, if you please come forward. I think we've had a public hearing on this before. Perhaps be able to be best to concentrate your testimony on the amendments, which we have not seen and haven't discussed publicly, but you may proceed any manner you want to.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record. My name is Jessica Harris Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We appreciate the opportunity to come back and talk with you about the Dash 1 amendments. Here today with me are Howard Carsman, who is an attorney with Bolv and Hauser Bailey, and Larry Sitz, who is the president of Emmerich Construction, a commercial general contractor who also does a great deal of project management, can talk to you about the differences between commercial and residential and the amount of quality control in that arena. We have asked for the Dash 1 amendments to be brought to this committee because we've heard concerns about the original bill that we believe to be a fair bill, but in an effort to help allay some concerns about the single-family homeowner. We have excluded single-family residential, and they will retain a 10-year statute of repose, but all other commercial and other dwellings would receive a 6-year statute of repose. We believe that this helps to meet some of the concerns that we've heard from smaller consumers who aren't as sophisticated in these transactions as the commercial owners, and Howard and Larry, being the experts in their field, are more than able to share additional information about that. Howard.
Good morning. I'm Howard Carsman. I'm with a Portland-based law firm, Bolv and Hauser Bailey, and we represent virtually all parties and have represented parties from all the different perspectives in these so-called construction defect cases. We've represented contractors, subcontractors, architects, engineers, and we represent homeowners, single-family homeowners, and homeowners associations. So there are some differences between the single-family residential situation that is represented by single-family residential owners and between the other classes of buildings which this bill treats as commercial structures. I think we're all aware of the fact that single-family homes, there is the likelihood that they will be sold not once but even twice within the first 10 years. So there are changes in ownership in single-family homes, and we have certainly seen the potential that a first owner may not choose to address problems with the house. And so a subsequent owner may be faced with problems that were not detected or repaired by that first owner. And I think that the amendment here addresses the problem that those successive owners may face, which is a home with serious problems and no likely remedy. But the phenomena of changes of ownership is not really present with commercial structures. Commercial structures are different in a number of respects. Larry's going to speak to the differences in quality control, quality and design and construction. But you have more continuity in ownership and management with commercial structures, whether they are true commercial structures or whether they are condominiums or townhouses. You either have continuity in ownership or in management. And so you don't have the problem, if you will, or the phenomena of with commercial structures of someone coming in as an owner and effectively not knowing or not being able to know what the history of the building was. There is a good deal more due diligence that goes on in the sale, purchase and sale of a commercial structure than there is in residential structures. So I think there are significant differences between the two. And then finally, it should be recognized that when there are problems with a structure, the problem only gets worse with time. The sooner the problem is detected and remedied, the less expensive it is to fix. The less expensive it is to fix is a benefit to the owner, and to those who are brought to the table to fix it, and to their insurers. I have myself been involved in many of these cases, including cases that have been brought toward the end of the statute of repose period. And I can say uniformly that the problems with those structures were apparent well before the lawsuit was brought. And by the time the lawsuit gets brought, the damages are far more expensive to fix than they would have been had the owners brought the case earlier. With single-family residential, there may be a reason to exempt them from the shorter statute, and that's because of these changes in ownership. But where you have a structure where there is continuity in ownership or continuity in management, there is no reason to wait 10 years to fix them. Those problems are apparent and can and should be fixed sooner.
Thank you. Next, please.
Good morning. Larry Sitz, Emmerich Construction, commercial general contractor doing business in Portland. We've been a commercial contractor since 1942. I'm the president of the company. We've done some things around the Capitol Mall you might recognize. We did the seismic upgrade of the dome of this building, did the public service building renovations, state library renovations, and a claim to fame, at least from our point of view, we did the state archives building. We think we did a wonderful job. Some of the people in the state think we spent too much money building it, but we didn't design it. We just built what they told us to build. So, and we think we did an extraordinary job. I'm also the chair of the Associated General Contractors Legislative Committee. And this bill's genesis came from that committee, and it occurred because a number of our members are unable to insure residential construction. And what's happening in our marketplace today, the socially correct thing to do is to do mixed-use development in urban areas. And that means a couple floors of retail and then two or three floors of residential construction. Well, the mid-sized general contractor, which is what we are, we do about $50 million a year in our marketplace, cannot insure this work. We cannot get insurance. Our companies will not give it to us. And it's because of the condominium aspect of this work. This bill won't necessarily solve all those problems, but it'll be a start of being able to create a marketplace that will allow our general contractors, smaller and mid-sized, to be able to do this work. We think it's really important that we're able to insure it. In the housing industry, we believe there is a fair amount of work occurring without insurance at all or without proper insurance. And what is happening with the 10-year statute of repose versus six or shorter, particularly in these multiple owner situations, what you really have is a board, and it's the board of homeowners, who towards the end of statute of repose, by fiduciary responsibility, there's a meeting held, or the other homeowners go essentially say, hey, we need to look at a building and we probably need to bring suit. We don't know for sure why, but probably there's something wrong. And they do. And they're doing it on a building that the general contractor's insurance has been in place for 10 years, but he hasn't been in care, custody, and control. The day the building was done, he essentially turned the keys over to the new owners, and the maintenance and repair of that building, we believe, is much more responsible for the results at 10 years than the original construction. Commercial building, particularly residential commercial building, heightened by this lawsuits and the results of these lawsuits, is becoming very detailed in making sure that these buildings do not leak. And it's the leaks that has been the problem. The buildings, some of the early designs for this residential work came out of kind of cookie cutter, if you will, out of California and Arizona, and they weren't detailed very well, and some of them leaked. They've been northwestized or revised in detail so they don't leak anymore, and that's real important. When the work and the difference between commercial and residential construction in that regard is that commercial construction, they literally draw all the details. In residential construction, you kind of get the floor plan. They tell you it has siding, it has windows, but nobody draws how those things really go together. In commercial construction, it's drawn right to the nth detail. You know where all the flashings are, what they look like, how they go together, what order they go in at, the sequence of construction. It's all in the documents, and that's different than residential. Commercial construction is inspected way more intensely than residential. The architect is looking, the structural engineer is looking, the public entity is looking. They all have inspection responsibilities. We, the contractor, are looking. We do not want buildings that leak. And the team, if you will, hires independent third-party inspectors who are also looking. And we're looking to make sure that that installed product is exactly what is drawn. And we have, as commercial contractors, have a way different responsibility for that result than in residential construction. We're held to what the book and the paper says. We have a book of specifications that's about this thick on a normal building, and a pile of drawings that is another inch thick, the size of this table. And we're held to, we must build what those drawings show. It's also different than residential. A lot of ways, what ultimately gets built never is really recorded in residential. Essentially, the homeowner may say, well, let's move this over here or that over there. It's kind of done on the back of a napkin, and it occurs. They all agree on a price, and it's done. That's not what happens in commercial construction. It's all documented, recorded, and what we build is what is drawn. And that difference, we believe, kind of changes the result. Our issue is that we're holding ownership or responsibility for a building that we haven't been able to do anything about for 10 years. And it's replacement of caulking and checking of things that need to occur, that's normal maintenance, that isn't happening, that's causing a lot of the problem. But when you get to the end of statute of repose, when it's at 10 years, everybody's brought to the table, including our insurance company, whether we build it right, wrong, or indifferent, and our insurance company settles because it's cheaper than fighting from their point of view, and money is put into the pot, and I guess the buildings are fixed, fixed against the maintenance that did not occur. And we believe that's the real driver of the problems that are happening. That's my testimony.
Fine. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you for being here this morning. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Garrard?
Yes, and I'm sorry, I missed getting
Howard,
your name.
Howard Garsman.
Mr. Garsman, how often is a single-family residence resold?
Don't know. I know that there, I don't know what the statistics are on the frequency of those, but in the cases that have come through our office, it is common to see a home sold at least once in the course of 10 years, and on occasion, twice, meaning three owners on occasion. Certainly two owners is not at all unusual within the first 10 years of that house.
Follow, Mr. Chair. I'm having a tough time with the amendment between the residential and commercial, in that it was stated that the primary reason is for leaks. It seems to me that 6 years should be plenty of time to find a leak.
It is, Representative. The leaks, to the extent that the leaks are the cause of either poor design or poor construction, they're going to start as soon as the building is done. And, in fact, they do. I've not seen a case where the leak starts for the very first time due to improper work or improper design. I've not seen a situation where the leak starts for the first time 5 years after the building is completed. It starts immediately. Mm-hmm. And then the damage just grows in time and time. And unfortunately, the longer it is allowed to go, the worse the damage, the more it costs to fix. So there is a prudent reason to bring that time period shorter so that there is responsibility on all parties to act promptly to fix a problem if there is one with that building. As for distinguishing between single-family residential and all other classes of construction, if you will, I think the concern is that of all owners of real property, single family owners may be least equipped to detect problems with their own home. That would be the theory. And perhaps it has something to do with the new materials that are used for construction, and perhaps there is more difficulty in finding a leak now than there was 20 years ago when we all had our first home, or 30 or 40 years ago. While I'm not necessarily sold on that, I would recognize that single family owners are not as knowledgeable about their buildings and don't have the same resources as commercial owners to deal with the problems with their building. And so if there is a reason to give added protection to a class of property owners, it would be for single-family residential owners.
Further questions from the committee? If not, thank you for your testimony, and we'll bring up the last two panelists, Lee Street and Paul Schneider.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Paul Schneider, representing Association of Oregon Counties, appearing this morning in opposition to House Bill 3158, and for that matter, the Dash 1 amendments. We have a group of county attorneys who advise us on legislation. There are four of them. And they recommended opposition to this bill. When I wrote them back, I said, can you give me any examples about what problems occur that would cause us to oppose the legislation? And one came back with regard to the Lincoln County Jail. It was built a few years ago, and it had defects that didn't start showing up for several years. A number of attempts were made to rectify the problems, but that didn't resolve the issues. They had leaking walls and joints in multiple locations. The architect and the general contractor blamed each other, one saying that it was faulty construction, the other saying it was faulty design. They finally hired a forensic engineer and brought action against both. The county attorney mentioned that he didn't know how many years after completion, but it was at least five or six before we got to that stage. They continued to point fingers at each other, but they finally mediated a settlement to fix the problem with both contributing. Would have been in trouble if we had any shorter period of time within which to file. These defects were hard to discover and difficult to pinpoint. They arose later rather than sooner because it took severe weather several years after completion to discover the extent of the problem and that it wasn't isolated. And so for those reasons, Mr. Chair, it appears that from time to time it happens where these things are not discoverable or the extent of the problem is not discoverable until after that 6 years goes by.
Thank you. Mr. Street?
Morning, Chairman Ackerman and committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I'm an attorney working with the Aldrich Law Office, representing Oregon property owners in construction defect claims. There have been a couple of comments made this morning that I'd like to address. First of all, with regards to the Dash 1 amendment and the original bill in and of itself, we're still missing the problem or missing the point here. I appreciate, and it affects my clients as well, that contractors are having difficulty getting insurance, or contractors are getting insurance policies that are filled with exclusions. But one of the reasons that this is happening is not because plaintiffs are bringing frivolous claims. It's because contractors aren't performing their work in a manner, in a weatherproof manner, or in a manner as in which to stop leaks. Homes are leaking, they're rotting away, and this is being discovered typically with, at least regards to my Oregon residential clients, it's being discovered 6 to 10 years after the fact. Taking away an Oregon property owner's right, be it single family, be it multifamily, or be it commercial, for the mere possibility that insurance rates may go down and that there may be increased competition, I don't believe it's appropriate. What we're looking at here is, again, not frivolous claims, but claims where you have water intrusion that is not reasonably discoverable within the first 6 years of, or in many cases not reasonably discoverable within the first 6 years after construction. You have cladding systems such as Hardy Plank, which is a cement board which you can't see through. You have cedar siding is the same way. You can't look and see through what's going on behind the building. Bricks, synthetic stucco, all these claddings look perfect from the exterior. But yet, when there is a problem that occurs, be it you get your 10-year rain or you get your water leakage into the interior building for whatever reason, you have property owners that are typically diligent in trying to figure out why their home is leaking or why their commercial property is leaking, and they conduct further investigations to see what the problem is. Typically, you find significant rot, water intrusion, and other problems. To the extent, as some of the other folks have testified, a problem is reasonably discoverable at the time of construction or at the time construction is completed, Oregon has statute of limitations which require that a claim be brought within 6 years of a time in which a plaintiff knew or reasonably should have known about the problem. Therefore, if they should have known about the problem when construction was completed, they are stopped from bringing any kind of claim after 6 years. But what the 10-year statute of ultimate repose is doing is saying, whatever the case, after 10 years, you're foreclosed for bringing suit. Now, there have been some distinctions made between single and multifamily dwellings that I wouldn't particularly agree with. I don't think it's a continuity of ownership issue. And in many of these multifamily dwellings, you have small associations which are made up of homeowners that are not any more sophisticated than any of the rest of the parties. They would have no more reason to know or reasonably should have known that problems were occurring, as well as small commercial clientele. They don't particularly have property managers on site or don't have teams of people constantly working on maintenance of buildings. It's, again, not something that a Oregon property owner would know about. And to the extent that, as some of the pictures I've shown, Oregon property owners knew that their decks were going to collapse in 9.5 years. It's something they definitely would have taken care of. Or they knew their buildings were rotting from the inside out. It's something they definitely would have taken care of. The homeowner associations and multifamily dwellings that I get aren't coming to me with problems or aren't coming to me with issues about being close to the 10-year statute of ultimate repose, therefore they better bring suit to fulfill their fiduciary duties. Rather, they're coming to me and my firm and other firms like and Mr. Carsman's firm saying, we're having water intrusion, it's causing property damage. We need the thing fixed. We need our property fixed. We can't afford to pay for it on our own. We need to file litigation to get the contractors to step up and fulfill their obligations and their insurers to do so. And trying to break this off between single and multifamily dwellings, or even between single-family dwellings and commercial dwellings, I don't believe is appropriate. Damage that occurs between 6 and 10 years of construction is still going to have to be paid for by somebody. the repairs are still going to have to be done or the damage is going to continue. What this bill and the amendment does is shifts the onus of the responsibility of the repairs not only not from the contractors and their insurance companies, rather it shifts the onus of coming up with the cash to make these repairs to an Oregon property owner. It's a homeowner, it's a city, it's a county. In some cases, it may be the state. It's people like the Port of Portland that it shifts the onus to. And a lot of these folks, I know the counties, and I know my clients, can they all afford to write $250,000 checks to repair property damage that they didn't cause. Also, with regard to the bill, it appears that it might even act retroactively to the extent that the committee was going to pass the bill, which again I would strongly advise against, but to the extent they were, it still should only apply to homes that were started after the enactment date of this bill, but that's going a couple of steps farther than I'd like to at this point. But at this point, I appreciate your time and the opportunity to be here this morning, and I'm happy to answer any kind of questions that you may have.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Girard.
I'd just like to ask you the same question I asked the other gentleman. Do you know how often a new single-family residence is sold?
I don't, Representative. I can tell you in my experience, and this is kind of off the cuff, but I would guess that about 60% of my clients, the ones that come to me the 6 to 10 years, are typically first owner residential homeowners. The remaining 40% or so have owned the home, are the second owner, or in rare cases, the third owner. And that would be the same, I believe, with single family or with my multifamily clients. Some of them were original owners, and yet others are owners that have been there, are the second owner.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative McPherson.
Chair. Mr. Tree, you distributed a chart here. I want to make sure I understand it correctly. It lists all the states and the District of Columbia and their repose periods. That's the top sheet here. And it is the additional discovery means that there's the repose period, if I'm reading this right, plus if you haven't discovered it yet, then a new discovery after that first column repose period then allows a claim to be brought then up to the sum of the two, which is what's in the third column. Is that right?
That would be correct. For example, with Illinois, as I believe the statute reads, to the extent that problems are discovered within the seventh, eighth, ninth, or tenth year, you would have an additional number of years to bring the claim. And with regards to this chart as well, I had provided some previous information from a law review article earlier to the committee. This is an updated version with current statutes. With regard to this chart as well, although I've tried to state repose periods generally dealing with latent defects to the extent there was some kind of differentiation, in which I've included that information as well, there are many jurisdictions that do not have any repose period for some claims, like a wrongful death claim, to the extent that on the photographs I showed that entryway had collapsed and caused someone's death. That personal injury claim would still be barred after 10 years. There are a number of jurisdictions here that may show six to 10 year statute of ultimate repose periods that still would have no repose periods for a claim such as that. And Oregon doesn't differentiate. It just simply says 10 years and a day and you're done.
Thank you. Okay. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, then thank you again for your testimony. Any further testimony on House Bill 3158? Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3158 and open a work session on that bill. And I think we must first consider the Dash 1 amendments. This would exempt single-family residences from the change in the statute of limitations. Is there a motion? And the chair will move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3158. Discussion? objections? Hearing none, then the dash one amendments are incorporated within the main bill. Do I have a motion on the main bill on House Bill 3158? Representative Rivard?
Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and move House Bill 3158 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rivard moves that House Bill 3158 as amended be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on the motion? Seeing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Edward? Excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 3158, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is closed. Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3317. Was Representative Krupp here to testify on that bill? I saw him come in and come out. Back. Let me see my sign sheet. Counsel, do you want to explain the bill, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3317 requires that local governments pay the attorney's fees and costs of the Attorney General for judicial proceedings related to unlawful actions by local governments. It also requires that the Attorney General pay the attorney fees and costs of local governments related to judicial proceedings challenging the legality of an action of local governments if the court determines that those actions were legal. Basically, this provides a system of loser pays the winner's legal fees and disputes between state and local governments.
Thank you, counsel. I have one person on the sign-up sheet, Paul Snyder. Do you want to come forward? And I think we're also going to wait. Well, we're not going to wait. We'll take your testimony, but I think Representative Krupp wanted to testify on this. Is someone going to call him, let him know that he's on? I appreciate that. Good morning again.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, we've had a recommendation from county councils to oppose this measure, but we wanted to identify a little bit more about the purpose and intent. It would appear as though its primary goal is to avoid litigation between local governments and the state. The difficulty, though, with respect to the measure that county attorneys see is often what happens with respect to statutes and other laws that appear to be ambiguous, and there's a reasonable disagreement about what it means and what we're supposed to do or what we can do. It happens often enough with respect to legislation adopted by the legislature, but it happens even more often with respect to legislation that's adopted by the voters, especially by initiative petition. The difficulty we have in those circumstances is that there's no opportunity to amend. There is no record. Anybody can do a fine job of putting together a piece of legislation and not anticipate the problems that come up later. I used to work for Legislative Counsel's office years ago, and I was frankly grateful for the hearings process in the Assembly that raised issues with constituents that nobody had anticipated before. Measure 37 is an example of the kind of thing that we have to deal with now, where there may be some ambiguity or reasonable disagreement between different levels of government. One of the issues here is that although it provides for attorney's fees in the event that a local government wins, in the event of a case that's brought by the Attorney General, it doesn't flip the case around so that if a local government files a case against the state, then the local government could prevail. There is some value. There is a lot of value in being able to litigate issues where there is reasonable disagreement about what something means. If we lose at the trial level, then we pay the attorney's fees for the state. On the other hand, if that case is reversed on appeal by the Court of Appeals, then the state pays our attorney's fees. And if the Supreme Court reverses the Court of Appeals, then the whole thing flips all over again. And the problems that we have are with respect to reasonable disagreements among different levels of government. We appreciate the fact that when government sues government, basically the taxpayer loses. But in circumstances involving cases like this, there are legitimate disagreements, and they've got to be aired. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Yes, thank you. Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Mr. Schneider, I'm confused about the circumstances in which the Attorney General's office would be required to commence or participate in judicial proceedings related to an action by a local government that's contrary to law. Could you just, is there an example or something that would help me understand that better?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we're reading it just as you are. I'm not sure when the Attorney General would be required to appear. The language, I mean, the Attorney General has the discretion to appear, but I don't know when the Attorney General would be required to appear.
Okay. That may be a better question, maybe for the sponsor rather than based on your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I neglected to mention that the League of Cities also has concerns about how the bill would operate.
Who's that, please?
The League of Oregon Cities.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Schneider? Seeing none, then you're excused for a while. Thank you very much. Representative Kropp, you're here on this bill. Welcome to the subcommittee. Are there any other proponents or opponents of this bill? I want to testify today. And let me just make an opening remark, if I may, before I get to your testimony, Representative, because I know you're here as a forceful advocate for your position. Conspicuously absent are state agencies which may be affected by this bill. I see no representatives here from the Attorney General's office. I see no representatives here from the Department of Administrative Services. You're here?
Yeah, Kevin Neely is here.
Okay. Excuse me? Well, I think it's important when it's any bill that impacts agency responsibility or agency policy, and it's been characteristic over the past several weeks that we have had bills before us that do that. We've had no representation from the agencies involved, and it puts us in a terrible quandary to find out what your positions are. So I definitely would like to hear your testimony. Okay, that's my comment for this morning, Representative. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 17. If I'm out of breath, it's because I have three bills up in three different committees, two of which are two flights below us, so I just ran up the stairs. House Bill 3317 is a bit of a different idea, I would suppose, and it is really born out of two things. The circumstances surrounding Multnomah County's decision to grant same-sex marriage licenses in 2004, and at the same time, as you know, I have a radio show in the Portland metro area, and frankly heard from a number of callers that felt that those types of actions that are sometimes engaged in by governments that ultimately are viewed to be contrary to established law, that are perhaps pushing the envelope, ultimately are bad policy and ultimately should not be brought forward in those manners. So I decided to introduce this concept, which basically says, whether it's any government that engages in bad policy that has a pretty fair shot at being overturned, I should think twice about that. In that, if they lose, they're going to have to pay the opposing governments, and this is the intent of this bill is to be related only to the expenses of governments as they are related in lawsuits to one another. Whoever loses pays. Whoever wins gets reimbursed. Now, it sounds simple, nothing in these matters ever is, as we know. We have spent some time chatting with the Attorney General's office. They've been very helpful in helping us understand potentially how these issues might play out in the future. This bill really does three things. I think it creates a deterrent to bad policy making. Those governments who, and I would suggest the case of Multnomah County is probably the most fresh and prevalent in one's mind, where a county council indeed interprets Oregon law to be something contrary than what has ever been interpreted before. At least that was my understanding. And the county then moves forward with creating what is, in essence, a different interpretation of state law, which then is causes the state to engage in legal action, potentially. I think it'll be a deterrent to bad policy. I think it'll save costs on frivolous lawsuits. And at the same time, it's fair to both parties, because the remedy here of whoever loses is the payer of the other's expenses. Now, there's clearly some inequities. Department of Justice's per-hour fee is considerably less than what cities and counties outside council numbers range. So there are, in terms of a fiscal impact anyway, at this point it's indeterminate. We asked the Attorney General that issue, their office. They do have some concerns. They don't know how this bill might relate to Measure 37 claims, which I think is an important point that should be explored and considered. The state, just for example, Multnomah County's circumstances cost the Attorney General's office roughly $60,000 in court fees. And in that case, the county first sued the state of Oregon. Now, the state sometimes win cases. In fact, they win more than what they lose. We have lost some cases. The PERS decision, which was in the millions of dollars, and I'm not... I know there's some impact there, but the PERS decisions primarily were labor unions suing the state of Oregon. But I think perhaps in one of those cases there was a local government involved. The Attorney General's office could probably explain that better than I can. But again, the concept here is to talk about is of this bill is to say that if a local government or the state, because this bill works both ways, if the state, if a local government engages in a direction that causes another government to join in or initiate a legal action for which they prevail, then they ought to be reimbursed. The argument is that there is, that these are all taxpayer dollars, and that is true. But ultimately, what we're choosing to say here is that in an era of what appears to be a permanent fiscal crisis of governments at the state, local level, that there are limited resources that are available to engage in these types of legal actions, and that instead of governments choosing to push the envelope, as it were, in an area that, and I have to admit, when we enacted certain PERS reforms in 2003, we were advised that we were on a bit of shaky ground. And for political reasons, we moved forward. For economic reasons, we moved forward on that. And I will admit to having voted for those bills, knowing that clearly it was, some of them were certainly going to be challenged, and that the basis for their legalities were indeterminate at the time. This bill seeks to cause us some pause as government officials at all levels before we choose to move forward with something that ultimately is bad policy or considered perhaps frivolous. And with that, Mr. Chair, I think that some of the objections that are raised and will be raised are legitimate concerns. I think we should have this discussion. I think we should explore it in its totality. And perhaps it's time that we move forward with a concept similar to this, or this concept, if the chair would so choose to move it with amendments, and I would be willing to certainly sit down and discuss those with any of the parties involved.
Thank you, Representative. I just had a couple concerns structurally about the bill, just looking at this maybe from a legal viewpoint. I don't see the reason why the Attorney General should be required to bear legal costs when their role is only to defend or advocate on behalf of the offending agency. So I think I just want to know, why did you feel the Attorney General would have to pick this up if, for instance, Department of Human Services was in one of these pieces of litigation and their authority was being challenged for having done something? They would be the responsible party, not their lawyers. And I'm wondering why you structured it so that the Attorney General's office would have to pick up for the default of an agency.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question, and it's one that I don't have a good answer for, to be honest with you. And I frankly, we left it up to legislative counsel as we described the intent of our legislation to put that verbiage in there. And to be honest with you, Mr. Chair, I would agree with you. Rather than make the Attorney General's office have to pay that amount of money, I think that's a very fair point. It really should be the offending agency who has moved forward with a policy, either in rulemaking or otherwise, that has created the issue, and I would be very amenable, Mr. Chair, to making that change.
And if I could make another suggestion, Representative, in defining what is lawful, I'm having a problem with that. And let me just suggest several gradations, and I'd be happy to work with you and legislative counsel on this, but I don't know whether you mean contrary to law or was lawful in terms of civil law or criminal law, for example. I don't know, perhaps there are better terms that could be used there, such as if an agency committed an action without legal authority, just went out and acted. That would be another, I think, definable threshold in the law. Or we have something that we also called ultra vires acts. Again, when an agency or a company acts completely without authority, they may have some responsibility. These terms are more legally defined than, I think, just saying that the we have to make a determination here as to what was lawful and unlawful. So I'm just sort of throwing those parameters out for you, but I think we're going to have to go back and do a fix on that.
Mr. Chair, excellent suggestions, and I'd be happy to explore that with you. I would say to you, Mr. Chair, that generally my intent of this legislation is not intended towards criminal law. It's more in the direction of civil law. I think the criminal laws are pretty specific and should be as they are. I want this bill to be construed as being applicable to those areas of law, unless there is a good reason why it should. And again, I would be willing to listen to those arguments also, Mr. Chair. Very good argument, and I'd be happy to work with you on the definitions and the verbiage there.
And then I guess my last suggestion, Representative, I'm not clear on a hypothetical that, engages this attorney fee provision. Maybe that's something else we can try to clarify later. I'm just hard for me to envision that right now. But we won't have to spend time on it this morning.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to sit down with you and further discuss that. I think there are others in the room that could bring you hypothetical examples of where this legislation could be both beneficial and also perhaps damaging, and we would want to look at those hypotheticals also, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative McPherson?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Krapp, I didn't, just I guess by way of comment, really track the comment you're making about the PERS litigation. That was action that we took at the legislative level, state government. It was challenged. Most of what we did was upheld. A piece was thrown out. It doesn't seem like it engages the issues in this bill, which relates to the relationship between the Department of Justice and local governments. But it seems to be driven largely by the litigation arising out of the issuance of same-sex marriage licenses in Multnomah County. And I guess what I want to focus on is the operative language here that the, the precondition that the Attorney General is required to commence or participate in judicial proceedings relating to the action. And when I think about the Lee case, I think the DOJ did participate in that action. It's not clear to me that they necessarily were required to do so, and I'm wondering whether the effect of this bill might have a chilling effect That is, when DOJ believes it's in the state interest of the state to participate, aren't actually compelled to participate, they may be deterred by the ante being upped. That is, that they could get their fees covered, but they also might have to pay the local government's fees.
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, very astute observation. That is one of the arguments why these types of loser pay provisions are generally not, shall we say, placed into the law in a whole host of areas of law, is for that reason, in that it would act as a chilling effect. And I would say that that is possible, that is an outcome. I would say that should be judged in its own right against the argument, and balanced against the argument, that by virtue of the fact that the Attorney General could make a claim that an action by a local government was unlawful, and that they may in fact prevail and be able to recover attorney's fees from that local government, that local government would be more cautious and more careful in its position that it would take in terms of leading to that circumstance. So those two issues, maybe they balance, maybe they outweigh each other, and perhaps that is in the perspective of the beholder and one's opinions. I think that it's time for us to have this discussion, perhaps to a greater degree, and that's why I brought this bill forward, in that policy is politics, and politics doesn't always mean good policy, and that's why so many policies are at times challenged in the courts, and I'm thankful that we have that remedy and that opportunity to do so. I just think that at times certain governments, whether they're state agencies or whether they're local governments, should think again very carefully before they push that envelope. And I think that's really where this is. You know, Multnomah County is the poster child for this issue because it's the most recent and high profile. I would bet you that if one did a fair amount of research, you could probably find similar circumstances on various governments and state government over the years in Oregon's history that would probably also qualify under this circumstance. So the chilling effect versus balanced with the deterrent effect, it's a fair discussion to have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. A further discussion from the committee? Seeing none. Your testimony is concluded.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your participation. We have some representatives from the Attorney General's office, or a representative. Please come forward and state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, Executive Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers. The Department of Justice did work a little bit with the carrier's staff in this bill, mostly to try and identify if it would or would not have a fiscal impact. I think that the committee has obviously discussed a number of the challenges that were faced in trying to craft a bill that addressed the situation that Representative Krupp was interested in addressing, and that was instances in which a local government takes some perceived unlawful action and subsequently the Department of Justice sues that government to stop them from implementing what is perceived to be an unlawful action. The fact is, it's very difficult to legislate against or find a way to institute a payment of legal fees when you have one of those cases, because they take so many different forms. And again, I think that Representative McPherson has hit on one of the real challenges here, the word requirement. There is never a requirement for the Department of Justice to undertake legal action, with a few very limited exceptions, and those would be times in which you guys passed a law that said we were going to go forward with some sort of legal action. And I'm not aware of that happening all that often. More often than not, what she'll do is say that it needs to go directly to the Supreme Court or something like that. I think we've seen a couple of sterling examples of that in the past couple of sessions. But just by way of example, in the Multnomah County case, that case was actually a case in which individual plaintiffs sued the state. The county was an intervener in that proceeding, but they weren't even a initial party. And I think that really illustrates the challenge of trying to address, if indeed the Assembly chose to address the issue presented by Representative Krupp. It really underscores, again, the challenge. And if you look at the PERS litigation, which you've already discussed, there are a number of pieces of PERS litigation, I would add. The one that sticks out in my mind is the litigation in which the city of Eugene challenged the state. And again, in that instance, the city of Eugene alleged that the state, in fact, the PERS board, was improperly implementing state law. That case is now in front of the Supreme Court, and we're waiting a decision in that case. But I rest assured, the legal fees in that case are very, very, very high. It's been litigated now for, I believe, about 3.5 years. It appears to me, based on a plain reading of this, that in that instance, when the county actually sued the state, that, again, as Mr. Snyder noted, the state wouldn't be liable. I think that over the years, we have found that that is, in fact, what usually happens, is a county believes that it should be able to do something that the state prohibits it from doing or appears to prohibit it from doing and sues the state. We can think of very, very few instances. In fact, we looked long and hard over the course of certainly the current Attorney General's tenure to find a case in which the Attorney General proactively sued a county based on unlawful activity, and we couldn't find any. We do think that probably the best example of one on the horizon is Measure 37. It is likely that we're going to have some real challenges ahead of us in trying to determine exactly how to implement Measure 37. And one of the ways that we might better understand the scope of that law is through reasonable litigation between a state and local government. But again, whether or not this would have a chilling effect either on the state suing or on a local government taking some sort of action is difficult to understand. And again, as I said earlier, I think if the Assembly was so inclined to try and move in a direction in which they wanted to try to implement a loser pays sort of scenario, we would need to think long and hard of an effective way to do it, if indeed there is one, because of the very, very varied nature of litigation, both at the state level and with local municipalities. With that, I'll be happy to try to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Just wanted to verify, we were told in prior testimony from the sponsor that the DOJ had spent, if I track this right, $67,000 in litigating over the same-sex marriage issues. Can you verify that, and how did that cost arise, if so?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think that is, in fact, the accurate number. I did provide that number to Representative Krupp's office. I can't remember right off the top of my head, but that sounds about right. In fact, I suspect that by now that number has gone up a little bit. What I can tell you is that that was very complex litigation, and we have, in the course of working that case to the Supreme Court, as you may recollect, right in the middle of the proceeding, a ballot initiative passed, which required about, I'd say, three times as much briefing as we would have in a case normally in front of the Supreme Court. We had a whole second and third round of briefing, and consequently, that drove the cost for our legal representation up.
Mr. Chair, if I could, it wasn't so much the trying to justify the cost. In fact, for any kind of litigation, $67,000 of any complexity. In fact, I'm amazed that it was as low as it was, but
But it was more than what occasioned this, the Department of Justice incurring those costs. That is, there was a lawsuit that was brought forward by, I think, people challenging the marriage statute in Multnomah County, or challenging what the county had done.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that lawsuit was initiated by same-sex couples, and it was initiated because the registrar refused to accept the marriage certificates. And so the state was the defendant in that case against, as I indicated, private petitioners. Now, in that case, Multnomah County was permitted to intervene. That was a prearranged determination when the lawsuit was brought, that no one would oppose that intervention. I appreciate you noting that that's pretty cheap.
Follow up, just one question. It would appear to me that even if this statute had been in effect, there would be no right to recover from the Multnomah County that $67,000 of cost, because that was not the Attorney General being required to commence or participate in judicial proceedings relating to the action. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, when I went over Hospital 3317 with Representative Krupp's staff, I noted that, unfortunately, because of the diversity of cases that come in front of the state and the way that we handle these cases, that it's very difficult to craft legislation that would be a real loser pays. And part of the reason is, and I think that the Lee case is an excellent example, it's very possible that the state could have sued Multnomah County in that instance. In fact, I think that was one of the paths that was considered. Upon reflecting on the law and reflecting on the actual facts of that case specifically, it was determined that the best way to get a judgment that would be effective for the people of Oregon, so we could actually understand what the law said, was to have the individual couples sue the state. And that was a decision that was made after extensive discussions pre-litigation. And I think, again, that's one of the real challenges here. There are times that we're going to have genuine disagreements about what the law says. And in those instances, the state will work closely with the county to try and find the most effective, expedient, and inexpensive way to resolve those issues.
Thank you. Further questions for the committee? What is the position of the Attorney General's office on this bill? I don't get that from you.
Sure. Perfect. I'm doing my job then, Mr. Chair. We don't have. I think that this bill, as it's written, it needs some work. But again, the Attorney General's position on this is that it is not likely to have a very chilling effect on our office pursuing litigation. Again, we can't find a lot of key examples in which this law, as it's written, would affect us. Consequently, we're neutral on this. We have no fiscal impact on this bill, or at least an indeterminate fiscal impact at this point. I think we would be very interested if, in fact, the chair directed us to continue these discussions and participating in those conversations to try to meet the Assembly's need while still preserving the ability of the Department of Justice to defend your laws.
All right, thank you for that answer. Other questions from the committee? If not, your testimony is concluded. Thank you very much. Further discussion or further participation, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just wanted to go on the record to express concerns, although we didn't know exactly how to read the intent of the bill. There will be legislation this session, we think, on deadly force, which may or may not include a required investigation by the Attorney General. That's what drew our attention to the wording of this bill. As a result of that, we would be pleased to be on any kind of a work group that might be formed to look at this bill.
Fine. We'll accommodate that. Thank you. Questions? See none, then you're excused. Thank you. Anyone else wishing to testify on this bill? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3317. I will not proceed to a work session because I think the parties all agree the bill needs some repair. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2373. Council.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2373 prohibits civil actions against manufacturers and sellers of firearms. and ammunition for damages caused by the unlawful use of firearm products. Specific exceptions include when the seller knew or should have known the purchaser was likely to use a firearm, cause physical injury, product liability actions, breach of contract, and violations of sale, marketing, and licensing statutes. This bill was originally heard for the Civil Subcommittee on February 16th.
I need a motion before we have discussion on the bill. I'm opposed to the bill, so I'm not going to move it. I'll leave that to the committee members. President Gerard?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2373 to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
President Gerard moves that House Bill 2373 proceed to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I'm going to be opposing the bill for reasons the state of your earlier hearing.
Okay, thank you. My involvement was in the bill that I pointed out to the proponents that it was most likely unconstitutional. There was a letter in the file from Legislative Counsel Dave Hendricks also stating, I believe, that the bill was unconstitutional. I suggested to them several ways that their concerns may be remedied by discussions in my office with their legal counsel and Representative Burley and probably others. They have not moved in their position to present any amendments which would, in my opinion, could have saved the bill from constitutionality problems. So with that in mind, I still intend to vote no, since I think we try to resolve our concerns, and there's been no effort to do that, and there's no countervailing legal opinions in the file regarding the constitutionality of this bill. So that's basically my discussion and my position on the bill this morning.
Chair?
Yes, Representative.
We, in fact, had conversation with Mr. Hendricks, Dave Hendricks, our counsel, and some wording we thought we had developed in a manner that would have a solution to the problem. For some reason, it seemed like we had difficulty in having him put the language in, which to my mind was pretty simple and direct as to what we wanted to do, and it didn't come out that way. So the sponsors of the bill decided to run it as it is, realizing that its fate maybe in the Senate might be already be determined, but we're going to go ahead and run the bill.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. Further discussion? I just want to make state for the record that the way the bill is structured, it bars certain claims. Some claims that would be barred under this act could involve negligence claims and nuisance claims, which have been the focal point of much litigation in this area. And withdrawing those claims from the court system, in my opinion, violates Article 1, Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution. And that was basically my discussion with the proponents of the bill. It was basically my legal position. I wanted to state that for the record. Further discussion then from the committee? Hearing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
No.
Chair Appleman?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
House Bill 2373 is forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation, and the work session on that bill is closed. Excuse me.
Carry.
Oh, Representative Gerard, do you want to carry the bill?
Certainly.
We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2730. Council?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2730 was originally heard on February 9th. It's the bill that provides civil immunity for radio or television broadcasters who participate in the AMBER plan. There are some consensus amendments. Those are before you, the -3 amendments, which combine the -1 and -2 amendments. There are two changes made on those. First, they clarify that cable companies that participate in the AMBER plan will be included. And they also provide that civil immunity does not apply for intentional misconduct or gross negligence.
Thank you. We should have a motion on the bill before we entertain discussion. Representative Gerard.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2730 as amended, or do we have to accept the amendment?
We have amendments to consider, don't we?
Yes.
Let's do amendments first, obviously. I think we're on the dash three, is that right, counsel?
That's correct.
Representative, do you want to make a motion on
Mr. Chair, I will modify my previous motion to accept the dash three amendments to House Bill 2730.
Discussion on the motion to incorporate the dash three amendments. Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, then the dash three amendments are incorporated within the main bill. Now, your motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2730 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves to House Bill 2370 as amended, moved to the full House with to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I believe it's House Bill 2730.
You're right, 2730. I'm mixing my numbers. Thank you. For that correction, is there discussion on the motion? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to state that I'm going to, I understand the rationale and the concerns that prompted the Association of Broadcasters to seek this immunity, I'm going to be voting against the bill. Just for the blanket immunity problem.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? The Chair is also is of the opinion that we have a constitutional problem under Article 1, Section 20, and granting immunity under House Bill 2730, so my vote will be no. I wanted to state that for the record before we vote. Further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative
Morris? Aye. Representative Garrard? Aye. Representative Worth? No. Chair Ackerman? No. Representative Klieger? Aye. House Bill 2730 as amended is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session on the bill is closed. Open work session on House Bill 2831. Council, explain the bill and what amendments are before us.
Chair Ackerman, the committee, House Bill 2831 allows municipal courts to assign judgments to criminal actions, in criminal actions, to the Department of Revenue. Before you have the dash one amendments, they merely clarify that the judgments must be payable to the state of Oregon in order for municipal courts to assign those judgments to the Department of Revenue. It's my understanding that all these judgments and these criminal actions are payable to the state of Oregon. Also, I received a fiscal from LFO that I will pass out, and it's likely that this will need a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Council, have you had an opportunity to look at the fiscal on this?
I have not really.
Okay. Is there already a subsequent referral on this bill?
There is not.
Chair Krieger, I have a procedural question then. We're looking at an unanticipated fiscal impact. There's been no subsequent referral. We can pass this, of course, to the
pass it to the full, and then
committee.
We can see if we can get it for that if we need one.
All right. Thank you. Okay, we're need a motion on the dash one amendments, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2831.
Representative Garrard moves that the dash one amendments to 2831 be incorporated within the main bill. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any opposition to the motion? Hearing none, it's allowed. And we'll need a motion for the main bill, please.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2831 to the full committee for referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Garrard moves House Bill 2831 as amended to the full committee with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing none, the clerk. Yes, counsel.
I just wanted to say that in my discussions with the Department of Revenue, I found this fiscal a little bit surprising because I spoke with the Department of Revenue and they said that they do these type of offsets for about 260 entities or agencies. And I guess my recollection of the conversation was that there would be an upfront cost to these taking on these situations from the municipal courts, but that they would eventually be recovered, so the fiscal might be one that is temporary, although this goes out 4 years, and then one where the costs are recovered. But I just wanted to let you know of that discussion I had with the Department of Revenue representatives.
Well, perhaps that's something we can work out at the full committee level. Okay, further discussion on the motion. Hearing none, the clerk can call the roll, please.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2831 is amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Do I have a carrier? I'll carry the bill. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2831 and open a work session on HM3. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, HM3 requires the Congress enact legislation to protect firearms and ammunition manufacturers, distributors, dealers, and importers from abusive and ill-conceived tort actions.
Do I have a motion on the memorial?
Mr. Chair, I move House Memorial 3 to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
The floor is moves House Memorial 3 to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? I'm just going to state the record. I again will vote no for the same reason I voted no on House Bill 2373. I think the memorial has the same defects. I also think that the federalization of the issue is the wrong way to go. And as a Democrat, I'm very, very happy to advance a states' rights argument before the full committee or before the floor. So I'll be voting no on the memorial. Further discussion on the bill? Representative Wirth?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to put my position, and then I'm also going to be voting against the bill for the same reasons.
Thank you for your comments. Further discussion on House Memorial 3. Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
No.
Chair Ackerman?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
House Memorial 3 is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will close the work session on House Memorial 3. That exhausts our agenda. Further business of the committee. Just hold on for a moment. I have a couple of notes. I don't know if they're germane. Representative Wirth, you've requested an opportunity to vote on House Bill 2221 and House Bill 3158 for the reason that you were testifying in another proceeding this morning. Is that correct? Okay. The chair would move to suspend the rules to provide Representative Wirth with an opportunity to vote on House Bill 2221 and 3158. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I would request the window of opportunity to also cast a vote on House Bill 2221.
And also incorporated with that, within that motion, Representative Flores' opportunity to vote on House Bill 2221. Is that correct? Hearing no discussion, that's allowed. Representative Flores, how do you vote on House Bill 2221?
Aye.
Flores votes aye. Representative Wirth, how do you vote on House Bill 2221?
Aye.
That's received. And your vote, Representative Wirth, on House Bill 3158?
No.
Is a no?
Yes.
That's recorded. Yes. Thank you for your participation. And any further business before the committee this morning? If not, we're adjourned.
Thank you.